Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Japanese. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and a director of New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and a supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear umami, ramen, izakaya, and so on, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a bit of mystery for many people, and I would like to demystify it in this program. So my guest today is Harry Rosenblum, who is the owner of Brooklyn Kitchen and The Meat Hook, a super cool grocery store, a kitchenware store, cooking school, and a butcher store in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And he's also the president of JCAN, the Japanese Culinary Arts Network, which promotes Japanese artisanal products in the U.S. Hello and welcome to the show.
Thanks, Akiko. Glad to be here.
So, luckily, I live 5 minutes away from Brooklyn Kitchen, so I go there at least twice a week. But for listeners who hasn't been there, can you describe what the Brooklyn Kitchen is?
Sure. The Brooklyn Kitchen, we describe it as a cooking store. We do three things. We do instruction, we do ingredients, and we do equipment. So we started as a houseware store in 2006. We sell a full line of pots, pans, knives, cooking tools, and small appliances. And then we expanded in 2009, opened The Meat Hook, which is our in-house butcher shop, where we do whole animal butchery, make our own sausages, our own charcuterie, cut everything to order, and then also sell now fresh produce and grocery items as well. And then we have two classrooms where we do about 50 classes a month. Mm.
So basically, if you can't cook, you don't know anything about food, but if you keep going there, you can be an expert of cooking.
That's part of the idea.
Yeah. All right. And how many products do you carry?
Thousands. Mm-hmm. I don't have a number off the top of my head, but we, as a store in each of the industries that we're in, we probably deal with more vendors than most. Certainly in the housewares industry, a lot of people buy from distributors who conglomerate certain brands. We have probably a higher rate of just single products from single vendors than most places do. We have try to have a close relationship and seek out the most interesting stuff, which of course means it's a lot of work for us. Mm-hmm. If we're only buying one product from a vendor instead of buying 100, it's a lot more work to put together the purchase order, to order the item, to get it in, to merchandise it, to sell it. But we feel strongly that that's really the way to have the best selection we possibly can. Mm-hmm. As far as grocery items go, again, same sort of thing. We have tons of vendors. We buy from all over the country and all over the world. Mm-hmm. To try and bring the best products to our customers.
Right. And I think you told me earlier that you have 8 times more items than a regular grocery store in the same size.
We do have a lot in the same footprint. I don't know what the exact math works out to be, right. But we do. And we're different than a regular grocery store or a traditional American grocery store, where you go to buy peanut butter and you're sort of overwhelmed by choice. You have, 20 different kinds of peanut butter. We have two. Mm-hmm. And we think that they're great, and those are the ones that we support, and we try to really know all the suppliers where we're getting our goods and be able to really understand and be transparent about the about the sourcing and about the supply chain. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the goal in everything we sell, and it gets a lot harder when you're talking about peelers and things like that, mm-hmm. is to really be able to tell our customers where every single item in our stores is coming from. And that's, you know, at this point, it's going to be a lifelong goal for me to get there.
Right. And you have a lot of unique artisanal Japanese products, and such as aged soy sauce, beautiful Japanese plum sauce, which I use on top of anything, almost pasta, and the turtle-shaped scrubbing brush, mm-hmm. something like you never see normally in this country. So why did you start carrying those items?
My personal interest in Japan goes back long before the Brooklyn Kitchen. My father worked for Hitachi in the late 70s. And so as a kid, I was exposed to certain pieces of Japanese culture. My father has never been to Japan. I'm encouraging him now that he's retired that he should go. But we went out for sushi when I was a kid in the late 70s, early 80s. And I would go to school and talk about, you know, how I was eating raw fish. And everybody said, ew, yuck, raw fish. And, you know, now, as you said in your introduction, you know, you can buy sushi or what passes for sushi in America at probably every gas station all the way across the country. Mm-hmm. Everybody's aware of what sushi is and what it represents. Mm-hmm. But I was exposed to that stuff at a young age. And always found it interesting, always really liked it. And so as I got older, I just sort of learned more about it and had the opportunity when we opened the Brooklyn Kitchen to start selling Japanese knives. Hmm. Met the folks at Kikuichi Knives, who are rare in that they are very old. They have a 700-year history of knife making in Japan, mm-hmm. but have an office in the United States, which most Japanese knife companies do not. Mm-hmm. So I was able to really meet them and become friendly with them, and in 2010 got to go to Japan to work with some of those knife makers, and that was an incredibly eye-opening experience. I'd always been to Japanese grocery stores here in the States and bought things that I thought were interesting, but to get to go to Japan and really see the width and breadth of what's available there that's not being imported here, mm-hmm. that sort of really, really spawned my interest mm-hmm. in trying to find Japanese products. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's getting better. It's gotten better in the last 5 or 10 years, the things that are available here mm-hmm. in the States, but there are things that we're now bringing in ourselves, that we are direct importing. We have tea from Murakami outside Niigata mm-hmm. that we are direct importing, mm-hmm. that we're the only store in the United States that sells. Mm.
So, you know, at the introduction, you're the president of JCAN. Mm-hmm. So can you tell us a little bit about JCAN?
Yeah, JCAN stands for the Japanese Culinary Arts Network, and it's a company that was founded by myself and the owner of Kikuichi Knives, Ikuyo Yanagisawa, and I have become friends through the knife industry from us being a customer. And after my trip to Japan in 2010, I started trying to find other things to buy in Japan. That led me to be identified by JETRO, which is the Japanese External Trade Organization. It's a government trade promotion group, essentially, mm-hmm. as someone in America who is interested in Japanese products. So they approached me in 2011 to go essentially on a buying junket mm-hmm. in Japan and see a bunch of products, a bunch of manufacturers with other buyers from America. Mm-hmm. I went on that trip. I couldn't turn down a free trip mm-hmm. to Japan. And when I came back, I was talking with Ikuyo about the fact that while it was great to get a free trip to Japan, mm-hmm. they really weren't spending their money very well. And clearly they had a lot of money to spend. Mm-hmm. The group that I was with was about 18 buyers from mm-hmm. the United States and Europe. I understood from our sort of JETRO handlers that there was another group in Japan at the same time with about 30 buyers from China. Mm-hmm. And then there was yet another group of American buyers with about a dozen other people. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about they paid for flights and accommodations for, including the handlers, probably 100 people or more, to fly them to Japan, business class, to take them around, to put them up in hotels, to feed them, to show them products with the idea and the goal to generate trade that we were going to buy things. Mm-hmm. All of the places they took me for 5 days in Japan and everything they showed me, there was not one product that I wanted to buy. Mm-hmm. And what that led me to realize is that they were clearly had money to spend, but weren't spending it in the right way mm-hmm. in order to really generate that trade. Mm-hmm. So when I returned and Ikuyo and I started talking, I said, look, you know, I sell lots of products that would do well in this market, mm-hmm. both in food mm-hmm. and in hard goods and regular products that don't need to pass any kind of USDA testing in order to be sold here, but nobody's bringing them in. Mm. Stores aren't aware of them. And some of them, like knives, knives are a really good example of something that's very easy to direct import. Mm-hmm. The shipping is very expensive from Japan. I mean, there's a huge geographic barrier there. But knives are a high-dollar item.
Right.
So on a knife that we're going to retail for $500, the shipping cost is not... But, you know, it's fine to add an extra $10 to that cost because we can eat that in the margin and have it be worth it. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to bring in a $3 trinket if you have to pay $3 to get it here.
Mm-hmm. Right. So other than knives, you know, after you established JCAN, have you imported something you feel very interesting, you're proud of? Can you just give us a couple examples?
Sure. There's a product that I actually found and bought at retail. I mean, the, you know, for me, looking for new products everywhere I go, whether it's in the United States or Europe or overseas in Japan, shopping in other stores is one of the best ways to find new products for our store. So in 2010, when I was there, I found this really neat little bottle opener. It's a bottle opener that allows you to then reseal a bottle of carbonated soda or beer or whatever called the Sizzler. It's a good name. It has a really cool package. It's a small item. It has a picture, actually, of a Western woman, kind of a 1970s looking picture on it. It's, I mean, the image of it is great. Hopefully, I'm doing it justice.
Actually,
on the radio.
I've seen the packaging, and then it was like one time in Japan, like so retro, and like a madman time.
Right.
So totally copied over to the Japanese market.
Yeah, and so it's very cool, and I think resonates now with the packaging with customer base because of Mad Men and things like that.
Right.
And if they were to change the packaging, the product wouldn't sell as well, honestly.
Right.
So that was a product that I bought at retail and then looked for a long time to figure out who I could buy it from. Finally found a partner in a small store in Japan who I said, look, can you get me a decent price if I buy a lot, if I buy a gross of them at a time or so? And so now we have this relationship where I'm buying some other items from that same supplier. And they're just a retail store. They're just giving me a slight discount. But the products are interesting enough and the pricing is good enough that if I order enough of them and pay the shipping, I can bring them over. So that, you know, that product is one that we've had for a while. It's not a, you know, it's not you know, going to pay my rent, but you know, but it's a neat little product and it got mentioned in Bon Appetit. So it was pictured in Bon Appetit. And so, you know, now we've got orders from all over the country for them coming through our website. So, you know, people are logging on to thebrooklynkitchen.com and finding this product because it was mentioned. And so for us, that's part of the, you know, it, that really supports the idea that it's worth finding all these small products because then if it's something nobody's ever seen before, you know, we get to be the introducer of that to them.
So any other products that you want
to... I mean, I think that, you know, the tea that I mentioned earlier, it's fantastic tea. I visited the tea farm. I mean, I, you know, in the store we have a picture of me standing on the tea farm. And so, you know, being able to connect people in that way, I think one of the interesting things that we have available to us now in the modern age, people talk a lot about local. And while I 100% believe in shopping locally, tea doesn't grow local to New York. So all tea has to come from somewhere else if we want to drink tea. And this was an opportunity that I had to go visit this tea farmer. Very small operation. He runs it himself. His father was a tea farmer. His grandfather was a tea farmer. And because we have access to things like jet travel and the internet, I could go there and stand next to him in his field. And I have met him, and I have seen his growing practices, and I have seen his roaster, and I can train my staff about what that's like. And then we're able to sell that product. And to me, that's part of the work that we're doing at the Brooklyn Kitchen to be transparent and to visit these places and promote these people who are really doing this work on a very small scale. And, you know, so that's it. I mean, that product, we haven't sold as many as we've sold of the Sizzler, but it's a really incredible product that nobody in America has any access to.
Well, in a way, though, right now, everybody's talking about local sustainable, but I think it's globally local sustainable. It's somewhat the lifestyle of...
I agree. And
what I appreciate locally, globally.
And I, well, I think the, and I think the idea of it being sustainable and of it really being about a community, right? And the word community, you know, really is not necessarily just about the people who live on your block or in your neighborhood or in your zip code or in your city. It's about the people that you're connected to. And so, you know, now that tea farm is part of the Brooklyn Kitchen community in, you know, in a very real way. In the same way that, you know, that the we have umeboshi, salted plums, that actually come from Washington State, being made by a couple there who are picklers, mm-hmm. who bought all of the plums mm-hmm. to make them from a specific orchard, mm-hmm. and they're making a Japanese product, but mm-hmm. they're making it in this country, mm-hmm. and, you know, we're connected to them. They're part of that same community, right. and they're across the country.
Right. Actually, I tasted that one, and then that was the funciest umeboshi in my whole life. Yeah. And I have to say, this is the tastiest. Yeah. It's like a, you know, the treat, like a caviar.
Yeah, absolutely.
Pretty expensive.
Yeah, it's expensive, but they're delicious. Yeah.
Right. And do you have any specific criteria for you to pick any products from Japan or anything?
Sure. We talk a lot about in our sort of sourcing goals of what we want in our products. And then there's a certain part of it that we always get to a point in discussing it where it's very hard to describe what it is about a product mm-hmm. in some cases that makes it great. Mm-hmm. There's a certain feeling about the product, but I think it comes down to, in a lot of cases, quality of manufacturing. Mm-hmm. In a housewares product, it comes down to quality of manufacturing. You know, we don't like to support products that are what Taylor, my wife and business partner, has termed landfill fodder. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't want to sell people things that are just going to break in 2 weeks, or they're going to lose one piece and it's going to become useful mm-hmm. or useless, and they're going to have to throw it away.
Right.
So quality is very important. Usefulness mm-hmm. is very important to us. And then look and feel. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot to do with look and feel. Mm-hmm. A good example of a Japanese product that we love, that we sell a lot of, is an ice cube tray. There's an ice cube tray that makes three ice spheres mm-hmm. that we get from an importer in New York. Mm-hmm. New York Mutual Trading imports them. Mm-hmm. And I discovered that they were selling them, and I said, we're going to sell these, and we sell lots of them.
Right.
It's a good price point. It's a neat thing. Mm-hmm. Everybody in cocktails is into these
right.
giant ice cubes.
Mm-hmm.
But the packaging is all in Japanese. Mm-hmm. There's no English on it at all because it doesn't need it. A lot of the food products that you see coming in from Japan have mm-hmm. an applied over label, which explains it in English.
Mm-hmm.
This product didn't have that because it doesn't have to.
Mm-hmm.
And it was great because it was very obvious what it was.
Right.
But it's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all in Japanese. And it's a neat product. And people like buying it because it feels special to them. And it's a great gift.
Right.
The supplier came to me and they said the next batch that they were getting from Japan, they changed the packaging and they translated it all into English.
Hmm.
And I said, well, I'm not going to buy them then.
Right. That's really true.
I said, you know, and they said, well, okay, well, what about just clear packaging? I said, clear packaging is fine. But to be honest, one of the things that helps sell this product
mm-hmm.
is not only that it's useful and it's a good price point and it's a nice product,
mm-hmm.
but that the packaging is all in Japanese.
Right. Yeah, I heard the sake, you know, the sake labels, which
yep.
is written in Japanese, sells more
yep,
than
true.
The translated one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is really strange because I think that you would see something totally different if mm-hmm. you had beer, for instance. If you had beer that was completely in Japanese and
mm-hmm.
people didn't know what type it was
mm-hmm.
and had no description of what it was going to
mm-hmm.
taste like, I don't think it would sell as well. And so it's sort of this weird thing where people don't drink sake in the same way, I guess, as they
mm-hmm.
drink beer, but
right.
in this country.
Yeah. All right. So that's great. And now we will take a quick break. And when we come back, we are going to talk about more about Japanese knives. Please stay with us. Hello, welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. My guest today is Harry Rosenblum, the owner of Brooklyn Kitchen and Meat Hook, and the president of JCAN, the Japanese Culinary Arts Network. So we've been talking about the products that Harry carries at Brooklyn Kitchen, and especially the Japanese knives. So how many Japanese knives, how many types of Japanese knives do you carry at your store?
Rough estimate off the top of my head, we probably carry a dozen varieties across different, you know, and then there are, within that, there are different sizes,
mm-hmm.
And then there are different manufacturers.
Wow.
And some of those we direct import from Japan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mentioned and spoke earlier about Kikuichi. They originated in Nara in
mm-hmm.
Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a family history that traces back knife making to sword making about 700 years ago.
Okay. So Nara is the western part of Japan near Kyoto and Osaka.
Yeah. Right. And their history, like many, many of the sort of older, more historied knife makers in Japan, is that they started out as sword makers. And then in the...
samurai sword makers.
Exactly. Samurai sword makers. And then in the 1860s, the Emperor of Japan outlawed samurais. And so in a very, you know, I think we can understand it as New Yorkers, in a very market-driven move,
right.
They no longer had a market to sell their swords. Mm-hmm. So they started making cutlery and started making knives. And so that history of making knives and kitchen knives goes back to that.
Right.
I mean, they were making knives as well, but swords were really their big business previous to that.
So the division is called the Sakai in Osaka.
Sakai City is a part, Osaka, yeah, is a part of Osaka, and that's where the sort of more traditional. That's the center at the moment, I would say, of a lot of the traditional handmade, hand forged Japanese knife making that's going on in Japan right now. The two major knife making areas in Japan that we deal with are in Sakai City and then in Seki. And Seki is sort of on the north side of the island of Honshu, on the main island. And it's more known for its factory-produced knives than Sakai. But there is some sort of overlap in each of those places.
Yeah, I read an article about, you know, how much of the Sakai knives used among professional chefs. It's 90% of the whole country. So it's still very going strong.
It is, yeah. It is going strong. And it's interesting coming from an American standpoint to go there and visit. I've now been to visit the knife makers we work with in Sakai 3 times. And it's very different than you imagine as an American, the knife making production, because it's not in a factory. You know, I think in America, when we think of things being manufactured in the modern age, ever since Henry Ford, people think of an assembly line where you're in a factory and you start out with raw material and it gets made into something and it sort of pops out the end as a finished product. The way that the knives are manufactured in Sakai is not like that at all. You have different people who are really specialized artisans who do one piece of the process, and then the knife itself and the pieces of the knife sort of move around between these people who are working on their knives. So you have a forging craftsman, and all he does is start with the raw material of steel and forges that knife and gets it to the right shape and gets it heat treated, and then his part is done. The blade itself then goes to a sharpener, and his only job, all he does is sharpen. He does not forge, he doesn't make handles. All he does is grind the steel, and he sharpens the knife. Then the blade will go to sort of the master knife finisher, who has arranged for the right kind of handle for that specific blade that's being made. And he will then, having ordered the handle from a handle maker shop, so there's a shop that just makes handles. They don't do anything else. They don't sharpen, they don't forge, they just make knife handles. And then the master knifesmith puts it all together and puts the handle on the knife, make sure it's straight, make sure everything's right, and does the final engraving. So most Japanese knives will have some engraving of Japanese characters on them, and that's usually the type of the knife, the manufacturer, information. And once it's engraved, it's considered finished.
Right.
And then it gets put in a box. And so, you know, in that process, when I sell someone a Kikuichi knife that's made in this way, you know, I know that Mr. Oe, whose house I've been to and, you know, who I've had many meals with, he's the last person to have touched that knife before I put it in the customer's hand.
Right. Amazing. So I'm sure he's been working on knife making for his whole life.
He has. I mean, his father was a master knifesmith. He's a master knifesmith. The guys actually, people listening to the radio can't see it, but I actually wore a T-shirt today that is from this group of knife makers who we work with, who call themselves the Kokajikai, and they're the young knife makers. You know, and the people that I visited there. You know, the sharpener was almost 80, the master sharpener, and he had two apprentices who were in their teenagers. The handle makers, the youngest guy working in the handle making shop, I think was 66, 67. And the Mr. Oe is, you know, he's in his 50s. And Mr. Anami, who's one of the forging craftsmen who I've worked with quite a bit and who was here, actually did a forging demonstration here in Brooklyn last summer. You know, he's in his late 40s, early 50s. But these guys are the young knife makers. And so there are not that many people, even though the sharpener did have a couple of apprentices, there are not that many people getting into this as a career. These guys all learned it from their fathers.
Right.
And they have it. And, you know, we're talking about people who, you know, work in a very small space. Mm-hmm. They essentially have, you know, a 2 or 3 story building. Mm-hmm. The first floor is usually their shop where mm-hmm. they're doing the forging, and they live upstairs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is their livelihood. It's their business. They work 6 days a week. Mm-hmm. And, you know, still... And this is one of the things I find amazing about it. You know, it's passing through all these different hands. Everybody has to get paid for his section of this work. Mm-hmm. And these guys, you know, they're not paupers, but they're mm-hmm. not, you know, they're not living high. You know, right. They're not living the high life, but, you know, they're making a living, and they have a, you know, a middle-class lifestyle.
Right.
We still are, you know, we're talking about knives that range in price, mm-hmm. for sure, mm-hmm. but on the lower end that we're able to retail at the Brooklyn Kitchen in the $200 to $300 range, mm-hmm. which to me is really amazing,
right.
that we're able to still get that product mm-hmm. at that price, mm-hmm. given what I know about how it's manufactured,
right.
and that it's not coming out of a factory that's pumping out 1,000 of them a day.
Right.
It's coming out of a factory where the forging craftsmen can make, depending on the hardness of the steel and the quality of the knife they're making, mm-hmm. you know, they can make between 4 and maybe 18 mm-hmm. a day.
Right. Well, somebody's like living their lives in medieval style, and then for the sake of making that amazing
yeah.
knives.
Yeah.
Right. And, well, you said it's harder, but I heard the Sakai knives, the average stainless steel knives have 56 GPa. It's a measurement of pressure at the gigapascals. And Sakai is 62 GPa, which is a lot harder.
Yeah.
So that's the handmade value of what they're making.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right. So now, what's the difference, other than that, you know, the Sakai and harder and steel, what's the difference between Japanese knives and the Western knives?
So, I mean, there are lots of knives made in Japan now that are sort of based on a Western style.
Mm-hmm.
But the major difference is that, traditionally speaking, Japanese knives are made to, they're one-sided. It's mm-hmm. a one-sided blade, so it's more similar to what we would know as like a razor blade that's flat on the back
mm-hmm.
or slightly concave on the back
mm-hmm.
and then has an angled side.
Right.
And the knives traditionally were only meant to be held in the right hand.
Mm-hmm.
You only use them right-handed.
Yeah.
And so the chamfer went in such a way that you were holding the knife with your right hand.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the last 25, 30 years, they've mm-hmm. started making left-handed knives, but
right.
they're very rare.
You know, if you're born as a left-handed, you're corrected to be right-handed.
Yeah, my grandfather was.
Yeah,
my grandfather had his knuckles broken in Catholic school.
Oh.
He was a Jewish kid, but he went to Catholic school, and they yeah. broke his knuckles when he was used his left hand.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. And
so there's a use difference.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you ask about that. So in Japan, the knives are one-sided, and in the West, they're usually two-sided, or the angle is the same. So the, mm-hmm. the chamfer comes in from both sides
mm-hmm.
Evenly
mm-hmm.
To a point on that knife. And the way the knife is used is very different.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if people who are listening imagine that a knife that we use in the West, you tend to hold it straight up and down.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is that that knife comes in at the same angle from each side because you're cutting straight down through
right.
whatever you're cutting. The way that a Japanese knife is often held, you're not actually cutting straight down.
Mm.
You're cutting at an angle. And so if you think about, you know, when you go to the sushi restaurant,
mm-hmm.
if you watch the chefs work, the other thing that they do is they actually put the blade towards their hand
mm-hmm.
in a way that we are taught not to do in the United States and in the West. The idea is obviously you don't want to cut your hand, but
mm-hmm.
we're taught to keep our hand away from
mm-hmm.
the knife as much as possible.
Right.
And often you see chefs holding something down like meat
mm-hmm.
or sushi with their hand
mm-hmm.
and slicing actually towards their own fingers.
Right.
Obviously the idea being that if you imagine holding down a piece of fish or a piece of meat with your left hand flat down onto the board
mm-hmm.
and you have a knife in your right hand,
mm-hmm.
that the way you are holding it actually is the flat side is up.
Mm-hmm,
and
right.
so the angled side is
mm-hmm.
sort of towards the board. That knife is naturally going to go towards the board
mm-hmm.
because the flat side is falling under your hand.
Right.
It's not going to go into your hand.
Mm-hmm. So, and they pull, you know, pull to your side.
Yes, you pull
right.
towards yourself
right.
Using a Japanese knife.
Right. So in the end, so the one-sided knife can enable you to cut slice thinly, most thinly.
Yes, I think it requires a little bit more experience and
mm-hmm.
practice to
mm-hmm.
use it well to slice thinly
mm-hmm.
than a double-sided sort of more Western style knife.
Uh-huh.
But yes, you can slice things incredibly thin with that knife. And you know, the hand forged knives often are carbon steel instead of
mm-hmm.
stainless steel, which
okay.
is an older material,
mm-hmm.
has a finer grain structure than most stainless steel, except for the most modern alloys.
Mm-hmm.
And so that allows you to get a much finer edge as well.
Mm-hmm. Right. And also heard that it doesn't stick to the food.
once you slice it, because it's one-sided, it's slightly bent.
Yep. Yeah, the way that the angle is on the front and then the backside having a slight concaveness to it keeps food from sticking to the blade.
Yeah. So there are a couple of different kinds of knives, Japanese knives, that, but which one do you recommend from your store for beginners who never used Japanese knives?
So I would say, I mean, you know, in the... For most people, if someone doesn't have a knife at all and wants to buy a knife, I definitely would recommend a more Western-style knife, but perhaps of Japanese manufacture. Something like a Gyuto, which is essentially a Japanese-manufactured Western-style chef's knife by shape.
Right.
You know, possibly a Santoku, which is a which means sort of three-use knife, Santoku. But it's the idea being that if what you are imagining a knife does, and you're imagining the way you've seen people use knives your whole life, if you were to just buy a Japanese single-sided blade, you're not going to like it.
Okay.
I don't think. But if you train with it, you know, you may be able to use it. And I would say probably something, I wouldn't recommend a Deba, which is a sort of much more triangular-shaped blade that's really for butchering, often for cutting up fish.
Yeah, it's pretty dangerous.
It's fairly dangerous, and it's not very useful, I don't think, to the the normal home cook.
Right.
But something more of an all-purpose knife.
Santoku.
A Santoku style in that shape. And one-sided or two-sided, if you're really interested in learning to use a one-sided blade, I think they're great. But it definitely is a little bit different than you probably imagine using a knife.
Yeah, that's great. All right, so, well, thank you for joining us today, Harry. And for listeners, if you'd like to know more about Harry's store, please visit thebooklinkkitchen.com. And if you have any questions, comments, please contact us at heritageradionetwork.org. And you can also reach me at akikokatayama.com. Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on every Monday and always available at heritageradionetwork.org. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.